private property. Why can't I be here? Shut up and get out of here. Go on back to the Zuzuya, shouted Kojiro, pushing her away gently. Akemi, panting heavily, shook her head adamantly. Don't order me around. I stayed with you, but I don't belong to you. She choked and began to sob noisily. How can you tell me what to do after what you did to me? After tying me up and leaving me on the second floor of the inn? After bullying and torturing me when I said I was worried about Musashi? Kojiro opened his mouth, ready to speak, but Akemi didn't give him the chance. One of the neighbors heard me scream and came and untied me. I'm here to see Musashi.
Are you out of your mind? Can't you see the people around you? Shut up!
I won't. I don't care who hears. You said Musashi would be killed today. If Seijuro couldn't handle him, you'd act as his second and kill Musashi yourself. Maybe I'm crazy, but Musashi's the only man in my heart. I must see him. Where is he?
Kojiro clicked his tongue but was speechless before her vitriolic attack. To the Yoshioka men, Akemi seemed too distraught to be believed. But maybe there was some truth in what she said, and if there was, Kojiro had used kindness as a lure, then tortured her for his own pleasure. Embarrassed, Kojiro glared at her with unconcealed hate. Suddenly, their attention was diverted by one of Seijuro's attendants, a youth by the name of Tamihachi. He was running like a wild man, waving his arms and shouting,
"Help! It's the young master! He's met Musashi! He's injured! Oh, it's awful! Awful!"
"What are you babbling about? The young master? Musashi?
Where?
When?"
"Tamihachi, are you telling the truth?"
Shrill questions poured from faces suddenly drained of blood. Tamihachi went on screaming inarticulately. Neither answering their questions nor pausing to catch his breath, he ran stumbling back to the Tamba High Road. Half believing, half doubting, not really knowing what to think, Ueda, Juro Zaimon, and the others chased after him like wild beasts charging across a burning plain. Running north about 500 yards, they came to a barren field stretching out beyond the trees to the right, quietly basking in the spring sunlight, on the surface serene and undisturbed. Thrushes and shrikes, chirping as though nothing had happened, hastily took to the air as Tamihachi scrambled wildly through the grass. He climbed up a knoll that looked like an ancient burial mound and fell to his knees. Clutching at the earth, he moaned and screamed,
"Young master!"
The others caught up with him, then stood nailed to the ground, gaping at the sight before their eyes. Seijuro, clad in a kimono with a blue-flowered design, a leather strap holding back his sleeves, and a white cloth tied around his head, lay with his face buried in the grass.
"Young master! We're here! What happened?"
There was not a drop of blood on the white headband, nor on his sleeve or the grass around him, but his eyes and forehead were frozen in an expression of excruciating pain. His lips were the color of wild grapes.
Is he breathing?
Barely.
Quick, pick him up!
One man knelt and took hold of Seijuro's right arm, ready to lift him. Seijuro screamed in agony.
"Find something to carry him on! Anything!"
Three or four men, shouting confusedly, ran down the road to a farmhouse and came back with a rain shutter. They gently rolled Seijuro onto it, but though he seemed to revive a little, he was still writhing in pain. To keep him quiet, several men removed their obis and tied him to the shutter. With one man at each corner, they lifted him up and began walking in funereal silence. Seijuro kicked violently, almost breaking the shutter.
"Musashi, is he gone? Oh, it hurts. Right arm, shoulder, the bone. Oh, can't stand it. Cut it off. Can't you hear? Cut the arm off."
The horror of his pain caused the men carrying the improvised stretcher to avert their eyes. This was the man they respected as their teacher. It seemed indecent to look at him in this condition. Pausing, they called back to Ueda and Jurozaimon. "He's in terrible pain, asking us to cut off his arm. Wouldn't it be easier on him if we did?"
"Don't talk like fools!" roared Ryohei. "Of course it's painful, but he won't die from that. If we cut his arm off and can't stop the bleeding, it'll be the end of him. What we've got to do is get him home and see how badly he's injured. If the arm has to come off, we can do it after proper steps have been taken to keep him from bleeding to death. A couple of you go on ahead and bring the doctor to the school."
There were still a lot of people about, standing silently behind the pine trees along the road. Annoyed, Ryohei scowled blackly and turned to the men behind him.
"Chase those people away!" he ordered. "The young master's not a spectacle to be stared at!"
Most of the samurai, grateful for a chance to work off their pent-up anger, took off on the run, making vicious gestures at the onlookers. The latter scattered like locusts.
"Tomihachi, come here!"
called Ryohei angrily, as if blaming the young attendant for what had happened. The youth, who had been walking tearfully beside the stretcher, shrank in terror.
What is it?"
he stammered.
"Were you with the young master when he left the house?"
Yes.
"Where did he make his preparations?"
"Here, after we reached the field."
"He must have known where we were waiting. Why didn't he go there first?"
"I don't know."
"Was Musashi already there?"
"He was standing on the knoll where...
"Was he alone?"
"Yes."
"How did it go? Did you just stand there and watch?"
"The young master looked straight at me and said... He said if by any chance he should lose, I was to pick up his body and take it to the other field. He said you and the others had been there since dawn, but I wasn't under any circumstances to let anyone know anything until the bout was over. He said there were times when a student of the art of war had no choice but to risk defeat, and he didn't want to win by dishonorable, cowardly means. After that, he went forward to meet Musashi."
Tamihachi spoke rapidly, relieved to get the story told.
"Then what?"
"I could see Musashi's face. He seemed to be smiling slightly. The two of them exchanged some sort of greeting. Then there was a scream. It carried from one end of the field to the other. I saw the young master's wooden sword fly into the air, and then only Musashi was standing. He had on an orange headband, but his hair was on end."
The road had been cleared of the curious. The men carrying the shutter were dejected and subdued, but kept scrupulously in step so as to avoid causing further pain to the injured man.
"What's that?"
They halted, and one of the men in front raised his free hand to his neck. Another looked up at the sky. Dead pine needles were fluttering down on Seijuro. Perched on a limb above them was Kojiro's monkey, staring vacantly and making obscene gestures.
"Ouch!"
cried one of the men as a pine cone struck his upturned face. Cursing, he whipped his stiletto from his scabbard and sent it flying with a flash of light at the monkey, but missed his target. At the sound of his master's whistle, the monkey somersaulted and bounced lightly onto his shoulder. Kojiro was standing in the shadows, Akemi at his side. While the Yoshioka men directed resentful eyes at him, Kojiro stared fixedly at the body on the rain shutter. His supercilious smile had deserted his face, which now bore a look of reverence. He grimaced at Seijuro's agonized moans. With his recent lecture still fresh in mind, the samurai could only assume that he had come to have the last laugh. Ryohei urged the stretcher bearers on, saying,
"It's only a monkey! Not even a human being. Forget it. Get moving."
"Wait,"
Kojiro said, then went to Seijuro's side and spoke directly to him.
"What happened?"
he asked, but did not wait for an answer.
"Musashi got the better of you, didn't he? Where did he hit you? Right shoulder? Oh, this is bad. The bone's shattered. Your arm's like a sack of gravel. You shouldn't be lying on your back, being bounced along on the shutter. The blood might go to your brain."
Turning to the others, he commanded arrogantly,
"Put him down! Go ahead, put him down! What are you waiting for? Do as I say!"
Seijuro seemed on the verge of death, but Kojiro ordered him to stand up.
"You can if you try,
The wound isn't all that serious. It's only your right arm. If you try walking, you can do it. You've still got the use of your left arm. Forget about yourself. Think of your dead father. You owe him more respect than you're showing now, a lot more. Being carried through the streets of Kyoto, what a sight that would be. Think what it would do to your father's good name.
Seijuro stared at him, his eyes white and bloodless. Then, with one quick motion, he lifted himself to his feet. His useless right arm looked a foot longer than his left.
Mike! Cried Seijuro. Yes, sir. Cut it off!
Ha ha! Don't just stand there. Cut off my arm!
But, you gutless idiot! Here, Ueda, cut it off! Right now! Yes, sir!
But before Ueda moved, Kojiro said, I'll do it if you want.
Please, said Seijuro.
Kojiro went to his side. Grasping Seijuro's hand firmly, he lifted the arm high, at the same time unsheathing his small sword. With a quick, startling sound, the arm fell to the ground, and blood spurted from the stump. When Seijuro staggered, his students rushed to his support and covered the wound with cloth to stop the blood.
From now on, I'll walk, said Seijuro. I'll walk home on my own 2 feet.
His face waxen, he took 10 steps. Behind him, the blood dripping from the wound oozed blackly into the ground.
Young master, be careful!
His disciples clung to him like hoops to a barrel, their voices filled with solicitude, which turned rapidly to anger. One of them cursed Kojiro, saying, Why did that conceited ass have to butt in? You'd have been better off the way you were. But Seijuro, shamed by Kojiro's words, said,
I said I'll walk, and walk I will.
After a short pause, he proceeded another 20 paces, carried more by his willpower than by his legs. But he could not hold on for long. After 50 or 60 yards, he collapsed.
Quick! We've got to get him to the doctor!
They picked him up and made quickly for Shijo Avenue. Seijuro no longer had the strength to object. Kojiro stood for a time under a tree, watching grimly. Then, turning to Akemi, he said with a smirk,
Did you see that? I imagine it made you feel good, didn't it?
Her face deadly white, Akemi regarded his sneer with loathing, but he went on.
You've done nothing but talk about how you'd like to get back at him. Are you satisfied now? Is this enough revenge for your lost virginity?
Akemi was too confused to speak. Kojiro seemed at this moment more frightening, more hateful, more evil than Seijuro. Though Seijuro was the cause of her troubles, he was not a wicked man. He was not black-hearted, not a real villain. Kojiro, on the other hand, was genuinely evil. Not the type of sinner most people envisioned, but a twisted, perverse fiend who, far from rejoicing in the happiness of others, delighted in standing by and watching them suffer. He would never steal or cheat, yet he was more dangerous by far than the ordinary crook.
Let's go home,
he said, putting the monkey back on his shoulder. Akemi longed to flee, but could not muster the courage.
It won't do you any good to go on looking for Musashi, mumbled Kojiro, talking to himself as much as to her. There's no reason for him to linger around here.
Akemi asked herself why she did not take this opportunity to make a dash for freedom, why she seemed unable to leave this brute. But even as she cursed her own stupidity, she could not prevent herself from going with him. The monkey turned its head and looked at her. Chattering derisively, it bared its white teeth in a broad grin. Akemi wanted to scold it, but couldn't. She felt she and the monkey were bound together by the same fate. She recalled how pitiful Seijuro had looked, and despite herself, her heart went out to him. She despised men like Seijuro and Kojiro, and yet she was drawn to them like a moth to a red-hot flame. A man of parts. Musashi left the field thinking, I won. He told himself, I defeated Yoshioka Seijuro, brought down the citadel of the Kyoto style. But he knew his heart was not in it. His eyes were downcast, and his feet seemed to sink into the dead leaves. A small bird on the wing, rising, exposing its underside, reminded him of a fish. Looking back, he could see the slender pines on the mound where he had fought Seijuro. I only struck once, he thought. Maybe it didn't kill him. He examined his wooden sword to assure himself there was no blood on it. This morning, on his way to the appointed place, he had been expecting to find Seijuro accompanied by a host of students, who might very well resort to some underhanded maneuver. He had squarely faced the possibility that he himself might be killed, and to avoid looking unkempt at the end, had carefully brushed his teeth with salt and washed his hair. Seijuro fell far short of Musashi's preconception. He had asked himself if this could really be the son of Yoshioka Kenpo. He could not perceive in the urbane and obviously well-bred Seijuro the leading master of the Kyoto style. He was too slender, too subdued, too gentlemanly to be a great swordsman. When the greetings were exchanged, Musashi thought uncomfortably, I should never have gotten into this fight. His regrets were sincere, because his aim was always to take on opponents who were better than he. One good look was sufficient. There had been no need to train for a year just to have this bout. Seijuro's eyes betrayed a lack of self-confidence. The necessary fire was absent, not only from his face, but from his whole body. Why did he come here this morning? Wondered Musashi. If he has no more faith in himself than this. But Musashi was aware of his opponent's predicament and sympathized. Seijuro was in no position to call the fight off, even if he wanted to. The disciples he'd inherited from his father looked up to him as their mentor and guide. He had no choice but to go through the motions. As the two men stood poised for battle, Musashi cast about for an excuse to call the whole thing off, but the opportunity did not present itself. Now that it was all over, Musashi thought, "It's too bad. I wish I hadn't had to do it." And in his heart, he prayed, for Seijuro's sake, that the wound would heal quickly. But the day's work was done, and it was not the mark of a mature warrior to stand around moping over the past. As he quickened his pace, the startled face of an elderly woman appeared above a patch of grass. She'd been scratching about on the ground, apparently looking for something, and the sound of his footsteps brought a gasp to her lips. Dressed in a light, plain kimono, she would have been almost indistinguishable from the grass, except for the purple cord holding her cloak in place. Though her clothing was that of a layman, the kerchief hiding her round head was that of a nun. She was small of build and genteel in appearance. Musashi was as astonished as the woman. Another three or four steps and he might have trampled on her. "What are you looking for?" he asked genially. He glimpsed a string of coral prayer beads on her arm, just inside her sleeve, and a basket of tender wild plants in one hand. Her fingers and the beads trembled slightly. To put her at her ease, Musashi said easily, "I'm surprised to see the greens up so early. I guess it's really getting to be spring." I see you have some nice parsley there, and some rape and cottonweed. Did you pick them all yourself?" The old nun dropped the basket and ran, shouting, "Koetsu! Koetsu!" Musashi watched bemused as the little form retreated toward a slight rise in the otherwise flat field. From behind it rose a wisp of smoke. Thinking it would be a shame for her to lose her vegetables after going to all the trouble of finding them, he picked them up and, basket in hand, started off after her. After a minute or so, two men came into view. They had spread a rug on the sunny southern side of a gentle slope. There were also various implements used by devotees of the tea cult, including an iron kettle hanging over a fire and a pitcher of water to one side. Taking the natural surroundings for their garden, they had made themselves an open-air tea room. It all looked rather stylish and elegant. One of the men seemed to be a servant, while the other's white skin, smooth complexion, and well-composed features brought to mind a large china doll representing a Kyoto aristocrat. He had a contented paunch. Self-assurance was reflected in his cheeks and in his posture.
Koetsu.
The name rang a bell, for there was at this time a very famous Honami Koetsu living in Kyoto. It was rumored, with considerable envy, that he had been granted an annual stipend of 1,000 bushels by the very wealthy Lord Maeda Toshiie of Kaga. As an ordinary townsman, he could have lived magnificently on this alone, but in addition, he enjoyed the special favor of Tokugawa Ieyasu and was frequently received in the homes of high noblemen. The greatest warriors of the land, it was said, felt constrained to dismount and walk by his shop on foot so as not to give the impression that they were looking down on him. The family name came from their having taken up residence on Hongami Lane, and Koetsu's business was the cleaning, polishing, and appraising of swords. His family had gained a reputation as early as the 14th century and had flourished during the Ashikaga period. They had later been patronized by such leading daimyo as Imagawa Yoshimoto, Oda Nobunaga, and Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Koetsu was known as a man of many talents. He painted, excelled as a ceramist and lacquer maker, and was regarded as a connoisseur of art. He himself considered calligraphy to be his forte. In this field, he was generally ranked with acknowledged experts like Shokado Shoujo, Karasumaru Mitsuhiro, and Konoe Nobutada, the creator of the famous Sanmyakuin style, which was so popular these days. Despite his fame, Koetsu felt that he was not fully appreciated, or so it would seem from a story that was going around. According to this tale, he often visited the mansion of his friend Konoe Nobutada, who was not only a nobleman, but currently minister of the left in the emperor's government. During one of these visits, the story went, the talk turned naturally to calligraphy, and Nobutada asked,
"Koetsu, who would you select as the three greatest calligraphers in the country?"
Without the slightest hesitation, Koetsu answered,
"The second is yourself, and then, I suppose, Shokado Shoujo."
A little puzzled, Nobutada asked,
"You start with the second best, but who is the best?"
Koetsu, without so much as a smile, looked directly into his eyes and replied,
"I am, of course."
Lost in thought, Musashi stopped a short distance from the group. Koetsu was holding a brush in his hand, and on his knees were several sheets of paper. He was studiously sketching the flow of water in a stream close by. This drawing, as well as earlier efforts lying scattered about on the ground, consisted solely of watery lines of a sort that, to Musashi's eye, any novice might be able to draw. Looking up, Koetsu said quietly,
"Is something wrong?"
Then, with steady eyes, he took in the scene. Musashi on one side, and on the other, his mother trembling behind the servant. Musashi felt calmer in the presence of this man. He was clearly not the sort of person he came into contact with every day, but somehow he found him appealing. His eyes held a profound light. After a moment, they began to smile at Musashi, as if he were an old acquaintance.
"Welcome, young man. Has my mother done something wrong? I'm 48 myself, so you can imagine how old she is. She's very healthy, but there are times when she complains about her eyesight. If she's done anything she shouldn't, I hope you'll accept my apologies."
Placing his brush and pad on the small rug he was sitting on, he started to put his hands on the ground and make a deep bow. Hurriedly, dropping to his knees, Musashi stopped Koetsu from bowing. "Then you're her son?" he asked in confusion.
"Yes."
"It is I who must apologize. I don't really know what made your mother afraid, but as soon as she saw me, she dropped her basket and ran off. Seeing she'd spilled her greens made me feel guilty. I've brought the things she dropped, that's all. There's no need for you to bow." Laughing pleasantly, Koetsu turned to the nun and said, "Did you hear that, mother? You had the wrong impression entirely." Immensely relieved, she ventured out from her place of refuge behind the servant.
"Do you mean the Ronin didn't intend to harm me?"
"Harm? No, not at all. See, he's even brought back your basket. Wasn't that considerate of him?"
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
said the nun, bowing deeply, her forehead touching the prayer beads on her wrist. Quite cheerful now, she laughed as she turned to her son.
"I'm ashamed to admit it," she said, "but when I first saw the young man, I thought I'd detected the smell of blood. Oh, it was frightening. I broke out in goose pimples. Now I see how foolish I was."
The old woman's insight amazed Musashi. She had seen right through him, and without really knowing, had put it very candidly. To this woman's delicate senses, he must indeed have seemed a terrifying, gory apparition. Koetsu, too, must have taken in his intense, penetrating look, his menacing mane of hair, that prickly, dangerous element that said he was ready to strike at the slightest provocation. Still, Koetsu seemed inclined to search out the good in him.
"If you're in no hurry," he said, "stay and rest a while. It's so quiet and peaceful here. Just sitting silently in these surroundings, I feel clean and fresh. If I pick a few more greens, I can make some nice gruel for you," said the nun. "And some tea. Or don't you like tea?"
In the company of mother and son, Musashi felt at peace with the world. He sheathed his bellicose spirit, like a cat retracting its claws. In this pleasant atmosphere, it was hard to believe he was among perfect strangers. Before he realized it, he had removed his straw sandals and taken a seat on the rug. Taking the liberty of asking some questions, he learned that the mother, whose religious name was Myoshu, had been a good and faithful wife before becoming a nun, and that her son was indeed the celebrated aesthete and craftsman. Among swordsmen, there was not one worth his salt who did not know the name Hongami. Such was the family's reputation for sound judgment with regard to swords. Musashi found it difficult to associate Koetsu and his mother with the picture he had of how such famous people should look. To him, they were simply ordinary people he had met by accident in a deserted field. This was the way he wanted it to be, for otherwise he himself might grow tense and spoil their picnic. Bringing the kettle for the tea, Myoshu asked her son, "How old do you suppose this lad is?" With a glance at Musashi, he replied,
25 or 26, I imagine."
Musashi shook his head.
"No, I'm only 23.
"Only 23?" exclaimed Myoshu.
She then proceeded to ask the usual questions: where his home was, whether his parents were still alive, who had taught him swordsmanship, and so on. She addressed him gently, as though he were her grandson. And this brought out the boy in Musashi. His manner of speech slipped into the youthful and informal. Accustomed as he was to discipline and rigorous training, to spending all his time forging himself into a fine steel blade, he knew nothing of the more civilized side of life. As the old nun talked, warmth spread through his weather-beaten body. Myoshu, Koetsu, the things on the rug, even the tea bowl, subtly fused into the atmosphere and became part of nature. But Musashi was impatient, his body too restless to sit still for long. It was pleasant enough while they were chatting, but when Myoshu began staring silently at the tea kettle and Koetsu turned his back to continue his sketching, Musashi became bored.
"What," he asked himself, "do they find so entertaining about coming out here like this? Spring's only barely begun. It's still cold."
If they wanted to pick wild greens, why not wait until it was warmer and more people were around? There would be lots of flowers and fresh green plants then. And if they wanted to enjoy a tea ceremony, why go to the trouble of lugging the kettle and tea bowls all the way out here? A well-known, prosperous family like theirs would surely have an elegant tea room in their house. Was it to sketch? Staring at Koetsu's back, he found that by twisting a little to the side, he could see the moving brush. Drawing nothing but the lines of flowing water, the artist kept his eyes on the narrow brook wending its way through the dry grass. He concentrated solely on the movement of the water, again and again trying to capture the flowing motion, but the exact feel seemed to elude him. Undeterred, he went on drawing the lines over and over.
"Hmm," thought Musashi. "Drawing's not as easy as it looks, I guess."
His ennui receding for the moment, he watched Koetsu's brushstrokes with fascination. Koetsu, he thought, must feel very much as he himself did when he faced an enemy, sword point to sword point. At some stage, he would rise above himself and sense that he had become one with nature. No, not sense, because all sensation would be obliterated at that moment when his sword cut through his opponent. That magic instant of transcendence was all. "Koetsu is still looking at the water as an enemy," he mused. "That's why he can't draw it. He has to become one with it before he'll succeed." With nothing to do, he was sliding from boredom into lethargy, and this worried him. He must not let himself go slack, even for a moment. He had to get away from here.
"I'm sorry I disturbed you," he said brusquely, and started retying his sandals.
"Oh, are you leaving so soon?" asked Myoshu.
Koetsu turned around quietly and said,
"Can't you stay a little longer? Mother is going to make the tea now. I gather you're the one who had a bout with the master of the house of Yoshioka this morning. A little tea after a fight does you good, or at least that's what Lord Maeda says. Ieyasu too. Tea is good for the spirit. I doubt whether there's anything better. In my opinion, action is born of quiet. Stay and talk. I'll join you."
So Koetsu knew about the fight. But maybe that was not so strange. The Rendaiji wasn't far away, only the next field over.
A more interesting question was why he had said nothing about it so far. Was it simply that he regarded such matters as belonging to a world different from his own? Musashi took a second look at mother and son, then sat down again.
"If you insist," he said.
"We haven't much to offer, but we enjoy having you with us," said Koetsu.
He put the cover on his ink box and placed it on his sketches to keep them from blowing away. In his hands, the lid glittered like fireflies. It seemed to be sheathed in thick gold with silver and mother-of-pearl inlay. Musashi leaned forward to inspect it. Now that it was resting on the carpet, it no longer gleamed so brightly. He could see that there was nothing at all gaudy about it. Its beauty was that of the gold leaf and color paintings in Momoyama castles, reduced many times in size. There was also a hint of something very ancient about it, a dull patina suggestive of faded glories. Musashi stared intently. There was something comforting about the box.
"I made that myself," said Koetsu modestly. "Do you like it?"
"Oh, can you make lacquerware too?"
Koetsu merely smiled. As he looked at this youth,
who seemed to admire the artifice of man more than the beauty of nature, he was thinking with amusement. After all, he is from the country. Musashi, unaware of Koetsu's lofty attitude, said with great sincerity, "It's really beautiful." He couldn't take his eyes off the ink box.
"I said I made it myself, but actually the poem on it is the work of Konoe Nobutada, so I should say we made it together."
"Is that the Konoe family the imperial regents come from?"
"Yes, Nobutada's the son of the former regent. My aunt's husband has served the Konoe family for many years. What's his name?"
"Matsuo Kaname."
"Oh, I know Kaname well. I see him whenever I go to the Konoe house, and he sometimes comes to visit us."
"Is that so?"
"Mother, it's a small world, isn't it? His aunt is the wife of Matsuo Kaname."
"You don't say!" exclaimed Myoshu. She moved away from the fire and placed the vessels for tea before them. There could be no doubt that she was perfectly at home with the tea ceremony. Her movements were elegant, yet natural, her delicate hands graceful. Even at 70, she seemed to be the epitome of feminine grace and beauty. Musashi, uncomfortably out of his depth, sat politely on his haunches, in what he hoped was the same fashion as Koetsu. The tea cake was a plain bun known as Yodomanju, but it rested prettily on a green leaf of a variety not found in the surrounding field. Musashi knew there were set rules for etiquette for serving the tea, just as there were for using the sword, and as he watched Myoshu, he admired her mastery of them. Judging her in terms of swordsmanship, he thought to himself, "She's perfect. She doesn't leave herself open anywhere." As she whisked the tea, he sensed in her the same unearthly proficiency that one might observe in a master swordsman poised to strike. "It's the way," he thought, "the essence of art. One has to have it to be perfect at anything." He turned his attention to the tea bowl in front of him. This was the first time he had been served in this fashion, and he had not the slightest notion of what to do next. The tea bowl surprised him, for it resembled something that might have been made by a child playing in the mud. Yet, seen against the color of this bowl, the deep green of the foam on the tea was more serene and ethereal than the sky. He looked helplessly at Koetsu, who had already eaten his tea cake and was holding his tea bowl lovingly in both hands, as one might fondle a warm object on a cold night. He drank down the tea in two or three sips. "Sir," began Musashi hesitantly, "I'm just an ignorant country boy, and I don't know the first thing about the tea ceremony. I'm not even certain how to drink the tea."
Myoshu chided him gently. "Hush, my dear, it doesn't make any difference. There shouldn't be anything sophisticated or esoteric about drinking tea. If you're a country boy, then drink it the way you would in the country."
"It is really all right?"
"Of course. Manners are not a matter of rules. They come from the heart. It's the same with swordsmanship, isn't it?"
"When you put it that way, yes."
"If you become self-conscious about the proper way to drink, you won't enjoy the tea.
When you use a sword, you can't let your body become too tense. That would break the harmony between the sword and your spirit. Isn't that right?"
"Yes, ma'am." Musashi unconsciously bowed his head and waited for the old nun to continue the lesson. She laughed, a little tinkling laugh.
"Listen to me, talking about swordsmanship, when I know nothing at all about it."
"I'll drink my tea now," said Musashi, with renewed confidence.
His legs were tired from sitting in formal style, so he crossed them in front of him in a more comfortable position. Swiftly, he emptied the tea bowl and set it down again. The tea was very bitter. Not even for the sake of politeness could he force himself to say it was good.
"Will you have another cup?"
"No, thank you. That's quite enough."
What did these people find good about this bitter liquid?
Why did they talk on so seriously about the simply purity of its flavor and all that sort of thing? Though understanding eluded him, he found it impossible to regard his host with anything but admiration. After all, he reflected, there must be more to tea than he himself had detected. Otherwise, it could not have become the focal point for a whole philosophy of aesthetics and life. Nor would great men like Hideyoshi and Ieyasu have displayed such interest in it. Yagyu Sekishusai, he recalled, was devoting his old age to the way of tea, and Takuan also had spoken of its virtues. Looking down at the tea bowl and the cloth beneath it, he suddenly envisioned the white peony from Sekishusai's garden and felt again the thrill it had given him. Now, inexplicably, the tea bowl struck him in the same forceful way. He wondered for a moment if he had gasped out loud. He reached out, picked up the bowl lovingly, and placed it on his knee. His eyes shone as he examined it. He felt an excitement he had never experienced before. As he studied the bottom of the vessel and the traces of the potter's spatula, he realized that the lines had the same keenness as Sekishusai's slicing of the peony stem. This unpretentious bowl, too, had been made by a genius. It revealed the touch of the spirit, the mysterious insight. He could hardly breathe. Why, he knew not, but he sensed the strength of the master craftsman. It came to him silently but unmistakably, for he was far more sensitive to the latent force that resided here than most people would have been. He rubbed the bowl, unwilling to lose physical contact with it. Koetsu, he said, I don't know any more about the utensils than I know about tea, but I would guess that this vessel was made by a very skillful potter. Why do you say that? The artist's words were as gentle as his face, with its sympathetic eyes and well-formed mouth. The corners of his eyes turned down a bit, giving him an air of gravity, but there were teasing wrinkles around the edges. I don't know how to explain it, but I feel it. Exactly what do you feel? Tell me. Musashi thought for a moment and said, Well, I can't express it very clearly, but there's something superhuman about this sharp cut in the clay. Koetsu had the attitude of the true artist. He did not suppose for a moment that other people knew much about his own art, and was reasonably certain Musashi was no exception. His lips tightened. What about the cut, Musashi? It's extremely clean. Is that all? No. It's more complicated than that. There's something big and daring about the man who made this. Anything else? The potter himself was as sharp as a sword from Sagami, yet he enveloped the whole thing in beauty. This tea bowl looks very simple, but there's a certain haughtiness about it, something regal and arrogant, as though he didn't regard other people as being quite human. As a person, the man who made this would be difficult to fathom, I think. But whoever he is, I'd bet he's famous. Won't you tell me who it was? Koetsu's heavy lips broke into a laugh. His name is Koetsu, but this is just something I made for fun. Musashi, not knowing he had been undergoing a test, was genuinely surprised and impressed to hear that Koetsu was able to make his own ceramics. What affected him more than the man's artistic versatility, however, was the human profundity concealed within this ostensibly plain tea bowl. It disturbed him a little to recognize the depth of Koetsu's spiritual resources. Accustomed to measuring men in terms of their swordsmanship, he suddenly decided that his yardstick was too short. The thought humbled him. Here was yet another man before whom he must admit defeat. For all his splendid victory of the morning, he was now no more than a bashful youth. "You like ceramics, too, don't you?" Koetsu said. "You seem to have a good eye for pottery."
"I doubt whether that's true," Musashi replied modestly. "I was only saying what came into my head. Please forgive me if I said something foolish."
"Well, of course, you couldn't be expected to know a great deal about the subject, because to make a single good tea bowl involves a lifetime of experience. But you do have a feeling for aesthetics, a rather firm, instinctive grasp. I suppose studying swordsmanship has developed your eye to a slight extent."
There seemed to be something close to admiration in Koetsu's remark, but as an older man, he could not bring himself to praise the boy. Not only would it not be dignified, it might also go to his head. Presently, the servant returned with more wild greens, and Myoshu prepared the gruel. As she took it up on small plates, which also appeared to have been made by Koetsu, a jar of fragrant sake was heated, and the picnic feast began. The tea ceremony food was too light and delicate for Musashi's taste. His constitution craved more body and stronger flavor. Yet he made a dutiful attempt to savor the thin aroma of the leafy mixture, for he acknowledged that there was much he could learn from Koetsu and his charming mother. As the time passed, he began to look nervously about the field. Eventually, he turned to his host and said, "It's been very pleasant, but I should go now. I'd like to stay, but I'm afraid my opponent's men might come and cause trouble. I don't want to involve you in anything like that. I hope I'll have the opportunity to see you again." Myoshu, rising to see him off, said, "If you're ever in the vicinity of Honnami Lane, don't fail to stop in to see us."
"Yes, please come and visit us. We can have a nice long talk," Koetsu added.
Despite Musashi's fears, there was no sign of the Yoshioka students. Having taken his leave, he paused to look back at his two new friends on their rug. Yes, theirs was a world apart from his. His own long, narrow road would never lead him to Koetsu's sphere of peaceful pleasures. He walked silently toward the edge of the field, his head bowed in thought. Too Many Kojiros. In the little drinking shop on the city's outskirts, the smell of burning wood and boiling food filled the air. It was only a shack, floorless, with a plank for a table and a few stools scattered about. Outside, the last glow of sunset made it seem that some distant building was on fire, and crows circling the Toji Pagoda looked like black ashes rising from the flames. Three or four shopkeepers and an itinerant monk sat at the makeshift table, while in a corner several workmen gambled for drinks. The top they spun was a copper coin with a stick stuck through the hole in the middle.
"Yoshioka Seijudo's really got himself in a mess this time," said one of the shopkeepers, "and I, for one, couldn't be happier. A toast!"
"I'll drink to that," said another man.
"More sake!"
another called to the proprietor. The shopkeepers drank at a steady, fast pace. Gradually, only a faint light outlined the shop's curtain, and one of them bellowed,
"I can't see whether I'm raising my cup to my nose or my mouth. It's so dark in here. How about some light?"
"Hold on a minute. I'm taking care of it," the proprietor said wearily.
Flames were soon shooting from the open earthenware oven. The darker it grew outside, the redder were the rays from the fire.
"I get mad every time I think of it," said the first man. "The money those people owed me for fish and charcoal. It came to quite a bit, I can tell you. Just look at the size of the school. I swore I'd get it at year end, so what happened when I got down there? Those Yoshioka bullies were blocking the entrance, blustering and threatening everybody. The nerve, throwing every bill collector out. Honest shopkeepers who'd been giving them credit for years."
"No use crying about it now. What's done is done. Besides, after that fight at the Rendaiji, they're the ones with reason to cry, not us." "Oh, I'm not mad anymore. They got what was coming to them. Imagine Seijudo going down with hardly a fight.
Did you see it?
No, but I heard about it from someone who did. Musashi knocked him down with a single blow, and with a wooden sword, too. Crippled for life, he is.
What'll become of the school?
It doesn't look good. The students are out for Musashi's blood. If they don't kill him, they'll lose face completely. The Yoshioka name will have to come down, and Musashi's so strong, everyone figures the only person who might be able to beat him is Denshichiro, the younger brother. They're looking all over for him.
I didn't know there was a younger brother.
Hardly anyone did.
But he's the better swordsman, according to what I heard. He's the black sheep of the family. Never shows his face at the school unless he needs money. Spends all his time eating and drinking on his name. Sponges off people who respected his father.
They make quite a pair. How did an outstanding man like Yoshioka Kenpo wind up with two sons like that?
It just goes to show that blood isn't everything.
A ronin was slumped in a stupor next to the oven. He'd been there for quite a while, and the proprietor had left him alone, but now he roused him.
"Sir, please move back a little,"
he said, as he put more kindling on the fire.
"The fire might burn your kimono."
Matahachi's sake-reddened eyes opened slowly.
"Mm-hmm. I know, I know. Just leave me alone."
This sake shop wasn't the only place where Matahachi had heard about the bout at the Rendaiji. It was on everyone's tongue, and the more famous Musashi became, the more wretched his wayward friend felt.
"Hey, bring me another," he called. "You don't have to heat it, just pour it in my cup."
"Are you all right, sir? Your face is awfully pale."
"What's that to you? It's my face, isn't it?"
He leaned against the wall again and folded his arms.
"I'll show them one of these days," he thought. "Swordsmanship's not the only road to success. Whether you get there by being rich, or having a title, or becoming a gangster, so long as you get to the top, you're all right. Musashi and I are both 23. Not many of these fellows who make names for themselves at that age end up amounting to much. By the time they're 30, they're old and tottering, aging child prodigies."
Word of the duel at the Rendaiji had spread to Osaka, bringing Matahachi immediately to Kyoto. Though he had no clear purpose in mind, Musashi's triumph weighed so heavily on his spirit that he had to see for himself what the situation was.
"He's riding high now," thought Matahachi antagonistically, "but he's due for a fall. There are plenty of good men at the Yoshioka school, the 10 swordsmen, Denshichiro, lots of others."
He could hardly wait for the day Musashi would receive his comeuppance. In the meantime, his own luck was bound to change.
"Oh, I'm thirsty,"
he said aloud. By sliding his back up the wall, he managed to stand. All eyes watched as he bent over a water barrel in the corner, almost dunking his head, and drank several giant gulps from a dipper. Flinging the dipper aside, he pushed back the shop curtain and staggered out. The proprietor soon recovered from his gaping surprise and ran after the wobbly figure.
"Sir, you haven't paid yet," he called. "What's that?"
Matahachi was barely articulate.
"I think you've forgotten something, sir." "I didn't forget anything."
"I mean, the money for your sake?"
"Ha ha! Is that so?
Sorry to bother you.
I don't have any money."
"No money?"
"Yeah, I don't have any at all. I did until a few days ago, but..."
"You mean you were sitting there drinking?"
"Why, you... Shut up!"
After fishing around in his kimono, Matachi came up with the dead samurai's pillbox, which he flung at the man.
"Stop kicking up such a fuss. I'm a samurai with two swords. You see that, don't you? I haven't sunk low enough to sneak away without paying. That thing's worth more than the sake I had. You can keep the change."
The pillbox struck the man squarely in the face. He squealed with pain and covered his eyes with his hands. The other customers, who had stuck their heads through slits in the shop curtain, shouted in indignation. Like many a drunk, they were indignant at seeing another of their kind Welsh on his bill.
The bastard! Rotten cheat! Let's teach him a lesson!
They ran out and surrounded Matahachi.
Bastard! Pay up! You're not going to get away with this!
Crook! You probably pull the same stunt all the time! If you can't pay, we'll hang you by the neck!
Matahachi put his hand to his sword to scare them off.
You think you can? He snarled. That should be fun. Just try it. Do you know who I am?
We know what you are. A filthy ronin from the garbage heap, with less pride than a beggar and more gall than a thief.
You're asking for it,
cried Matahachi, glaring and knitting his brow fiercely.
You'd sing a different tune if you knew my name.
Your name? What's so special about it?
I am Sasaki Kojiro, fellow student of Ito Itosai, swordsman of the Chūjō style. You must have heard of me.
Don't make me laugh. Never mind the fancy names, just pay up.
One man stretched out his hand to grab at Matahachi, who cried, If the pillbox isn't enough, I'll give you a bit of my sword, too. Quickly drawing the weapon, he struck at the man's hand, cutting it clean off. The others, seeing that they had underestimated their adversary, reacted as if it were their blood that had been spilled. They sprinted off into the darkness. A look of triumph on his face, Matahachi challenged them anyway.
Come back, you vermin! I'll show you how Kojiro uses his sword when he's serious. Come on, I'll take your heads off for you.
He looked up at the heavens and giggled, his white teeth gleaming in the darkness as he exulted over his success. Then, abruptly, his mood changed. His face wrapped in sadness, he seemed on the verge of tears. Ramming his sword clumsily back into its scabbard, he started walking unsteadily away. The pillbox on the ground sparkled under the stars. Made of black sandalwood with a shell inlay, it didn't look very valuable, but a glint of the blue nacre gave it the subtle beauty of a tiny cluster of fireflies. Coming out of the shack, the itinerant monk saw the pillbox and picked it up. He started to walk on, but then went back and stood under the shop's eaves. In the dim light from a crack in the wall, he examined the design and the cord carefully. He thought. This is definitely the master's. He must have had it with him when he was killed at Fushimi Castle. Yes, here's his name, Tenki, written on the bottom. The monk hurried off after Matahachi.
Sasaki! He called. Sasaki Kojiro!
Matahachi heard the name, but in his befuddled condition, failed this time to connect it with himself. He stumbled on from Kujō Avenue up Horikawa Street. The monk caught up with him and took hold of the end of his scabbard.
Wait, Kojiro, he said. Wait just a moment.
Matahachi
hiccuped.
Do you mean me?
You're Sasaki Kojiro, aren't you?
A severe light shone in the monk's eyes. Matahachi became slightly more sober.
Yes, I'm Kojiro. What's that got to do with you?
I want to ask you a question.
Well, what is it?
Just where did you get this pillbox?
Pillbox? He asked vacantly.
Yes, where did you get it? That's all I want to know. How did it come into your possession?
The monk spoke rather formally. He was still young, perhaps 26 or so, and did not appear to be one of the spiritless beggar monks who wandered from temple to temple living on charity. In one hand he had a round oak staff, more than 6 feet long.
"Who are you anyway?"
demanded Matahachi, concern beginning to show on his face.
"That doesn't matter. Why don't you just tell me where this came from?"
"It didn't come from anywhere. It's mine. Always has been."
"You're lying. Tell me the truth."
"I've told you the truth already."
"You refuse to confess?"
"Confess to what?"
asked Matahachi innocently.
"You're not Kojiro."
Immediately the staff in the monk's hand split the air. Matahachi's instincts pulled him backward, but he was still too groggy to react quickly.
The staff connected, and with a shriek of pain, he staggered back 15 or 20 feet before landing on his backside. On his feet again, he took off.